From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, April 19th through Friday, April 23rd, 2021. It was a week of life and death drama on all fronts. Stand by, as we're about to be joined by media thought leaders left, right, and center. How's that for a dangerous radio concept? Opinionated folks with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation in a deafeningly noisy world in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, an examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information is gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. And I wrote and recorded a song that I'll perform for you during the next hour. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, the death of Walter Mondale, tied with the Mars helicopter takes flight. The man who served as vice president in the Jimmy Carter administration passed away at 93. He lost his own bid for the presidency to Ronald Reagan in 1984, but will be remembered for selecting the first female running mate nominated by a major political party, Geraldine Ferraro.
In an amazing scientific achievement, the helicopter Ingenuity successfully completed two flights on Mars this week, a challenging feat considering the red planet's thin air and low gravity.
At number 9, Earth Day tied with the Biden Climate Summit. Thursday was Earth Day, and it kicked off a virtual international climate summit with the goal of lowering carbon emissions into the atmosphere.
The attendees included leaders of 40 nations, including Xi Jinping from China and Vladimir Putin from Russia, not to mention the Pope, along with executives from major industries and climate experts. Can the U.S. work cooperatively with China on climate change, with all the other issues tearing the two superpowers apart?
At number 8, U.S. relations with China, Russia, Iran, Afghanistan, and North Korea. The international situation grows increasingly tense as the Biden administration faces dangerous hotspots all over the world.
China has increased its militarization of the South China Sea and its looming threat to Taiwan. Russia is amassing troops on the Ukrainian border. Talks with Iran to restore the 2015 nuclear deal are proceeding, but very slowly. The withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan is not without its dangers and strategic controversy, and North Korea keeps building up its nukes.
At number 7 this week, southern border crisis and immigration reform. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey announced Tuesday he's deploying the state's National Guard to the border and is issuing an emergency declaration in response to the growing migrant crisis that has overwhelmed local officials.
Biden put Vice President Kamala Harris in charge of handling the surge of migrants at the border last month, but she has yet to make a visit or hold a news conference.
At number 6, education and school openings. School districts all across America are struggling to figure out ways to open the schools and restore in-classroom learning.
Although much progress has been made this past year in remote education and homeschooling, for the most part, it seems that parents and students alike are just about all zoomed out.
At number 5 this week, the economy, the Biden stimulus agenda, and the easing of regulations and mandates. Right now, it's still confusing, but Americans continue to receive financial relief as part of the massive $1.9 trillion stimulus package Congress approved in March. The American Rescue Plan payments span one-time $1,400 stimulus checks and multiple child tax credit payments to monthly $300 checks to fill in for lost wages for unemployed workers.
As the vaccinations bring the nation closer to the goal of herd immunity, the easing of mandates and regulations are increasingly opening businesses and sparking optimism in the trading markets.
At number 4, COVID-19 vaccines, variants, politics, and stats. Half of American adults have received at least the first of their two vaccinations.
The challenge now is to get the other half willing to be vaccinated and overcome their hesitancy and reluctance. The issue remains politicized and subject to varying opinions and a ton of misinformation. All this against the backdrop of surges and hotspots due to the spread of variants around the nation and the globe.
At number three this week, gun control, gun violence, and mass murder in America. Over 100 Americans have been killed in 45 mass shootings since 8 people died at the Atlanta spas on March 16.
And it's becoming increasingly difficult to wrap our brains around the collective numbness people describe feeling as a result of the ongoing emotional overload that these statistics hoist upon our nervous systems.
At number two this week, police reform, the Makia Bryant shooting, and the LeBron James tweet. The call for police reform grows louder in the wake of the disturbing evidence provided by witness after witness at the high-profile trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. But most reasonable people on both sides of the political spectrum agree that the vast majority of police officers in America are brave, honest, and necessary to protect and preserve public safety.
Saying they want to be transparent in the investigation, the city of Columbus, Ohio, released more information in dash cam video on Thursday involving the fatal police shooting of 16-year-old Makia Bryant. Basketball superstar LeBron James, a native of Ohio, became embroiled in the story by issuing an angry tweet about the disturbing incident, which he quickly retracted, following it up in another tweet saying, "I'm so damn tired of seeing black people killed by police. I took the tweet down because it's being used to create more hate. This isn't about one officer. It's about the entire system, and they always use our words to create more racism. I'm so desperate for more accountability."
And at number one this week, the Derek Chauvin trial and verdict tied with race relations. The nation was on the edge of its collective seat awaiting the verdict of guilty on all three counts, which came surprisingly quickly.
On today's program, we'll be presenting two views of the trial, police reform, and the state of race relations in America from the leading African-American news talk radio thought leaders from the left and the right. Stay right where you are for the next hour. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Even though we're still entrenched in the uncertainty, grief, discomfort, and discord of the pandemic, the Minneapolis trial and verdict of former police officer Derek Chauvin, who was found guilty of murdering George Floyd, was the dominant topic of conversation on the talk shows of America this past week. We reached out to two of the most influential African-American talk show hosts on the radio today. Each brings a significantly different perspective to the table, which clearly indicates that although a majority of black America found comfort and relief in the jury's three-count guilty verdict, not all African Americans see eye to eye on this issue or on politics in general. Let's start with the Salem Radio Network, nationally syndicated conservative thought leader, author, lawyer, and filmmaker, Larry Elder. So, Larry, before the verdict was announced, during that hour and a half, when we knew there was a verdict, people were speculating on what the result might be because it was so quick, and then it was announced. What did you expect, and were you surprised?
I will tell you this. I watched as much of it as I could, particularly the most important witnesses, the witnesses that talked about use of force for both sides, that talked about the cause of death for both sides. And I thought that at least one or more juror would hold out and they would not get a conviction of any of the counts. That said, I said at the very beginning, and I say right now, that was a trial about a specific police officer who allegedly murdered a specific civilian. Nothing more, nothing less. Even during the opening statement, the state made a big deal out of saying the Minneapolis Police Department was not on trial, let alone America, and that the officers have a very difficult job. This particular officer is on trial for this particular set of charges. Nothing more, nothing less. That's what the prosecution said in their opening statement. I watched the trial on HLN. That's the cable channel that carried it gavel to gavel. And they would bump in and out, Michael, with a little graphic, a big graphic with an American flag and a fist tearing it in half with the following graphic: America's very soul is on trial, end of quote. Again, BS. That's the narrative that the media runs with, that Democrats run with for votes. Media does it for ratings, and this is that America is a country where the police engage in systemic racism against blacks. And it is a damnable lie. And it's not just a usual left-wing lie that that you just know is wrong-headed but doesn't have any real consequences. This has real consequences. When you accuse the police of engaging in systemic racism, as happened outside, as happened in Ferguson, crime went up dramatically in St. Louis right outside Ferguson. Same thing happened after Freddie Gray died in Baltimore. Same thing happened after George Floyd died in Minneapolis. You have violence going up because cops pull back. It's called the Ferguson effect. Now it's called the Minneapolis effect. Some people have called it the George Floyd effect. But Heather McDonald has talked about this, the woman who's done a great deal of research on the police. She wrote a book called The War on Cops. She is a fellow with the Manhattan Institute in New York. And she says that, and her research has shown that when the officers pull back, crime goes up. Bad guys know it. Moreover, what happens, in my opinion, is young black men are taught that the police are not there to help you, to protect and serve. They're there to hurt you. I forget which prominent politician, I believe it was Maxine Waters or one of them, said something to the effect that the police are there to keep you in your place, close quote. So if you're told this by the likes of people everywhere from Al Sharpton to Eric Holder to Barack Obama, and I'm pulled over and I'm a young black man, why in the world, Michael, should I cooperate? Why should I comply? Why should I follow the mantra that Larry Elder has been pushing, comply, you won't die? If I feel this officer is an enemy of mine, why in the world should I cooperate? So ordinary encounters escalate to DEFCON 1 as a result of young black men's sincerely believing the lies that they have been pushed. And by lies, I mean this, Michael. There are 50 million police-civilian interactions every single year out of roughly 800,000 sworn officers. 11 million arrests result from the 50 million encounters. Out of that 11 million arrests, 60,000 officers are assaulted. Last year, between 50 and 60 officers were killed in the line of duty. Out of all of that, in a population of 350 million Americans, 1,000 people have been killed on average by the police in the last few years, according to the Washington Post. Out of that number, 500,000 are white, 250 are black, which means the police are killing twice as many whites as blacks. It is true that the rate at which blacks are being killed by the police is higher, 2.5 times higher, but it is also true that the rate at which young black men, and that's the category where most homicide victims take place, it's also true that young black men are 8 to 10 times more likely to be a victim of a homicide than a young white man. And almost always the victim of that homicide is another young black man, as homicide is almost always a same race crime. Out of the 7,000 homicide victims last year, and that's 50% of the total, 50% of the total come from 13% of the population, Michael. And you throw out women, because most murders are committed by men against men, throw out really, really young men, you're talking about 3% of the population, that's young black men committing almost half of the homicides in this country. Out of the 7,000 homicide victims, a whopping total of 0.25% were unarmed blacks shot by the police. You want to throw in all the people who have died in other means, as was the case with George Floyd, you're talking about maybe 25 unarmed blacks killed by the police every year. That represents 0.33% of all the black victims in America. It is also false that the police are engaging in lethal force against blacks just because they're black. There have been massive studies about this. Washington Post, again, I try and use sources that the left can't condemn right away. The Washington Post, April 27, 2016, I know the date because that's my birthday, April 27, a massive, massive article in the front page about all these studies going back over decades showing that the police not only are not using deadly force against blacks just because they're black, but the police are more hesitant, more reluctant to pull the trigger on a black suspect than on a white suspect. There have been researchers from the Washington State University that have done these research 3 times over several decades, and each time the result has been the same. The police are 3 times more hesitant to pull the trigger on a black suspect than on a white suspect. It's also the same year in New York. New York Times, July of 2016, front page article about a black Harvard economist named Roland Fryer, F-R-Y-E-R. He has also done a study, and he said he was shocked. Before before he did his study, he just knew because of these high-profile killings, whether it was Eric Garner in New York or Freddie Gray in Baltimore or Tamir Rice, the one who had the replica gun in Cleveland, or Michael Brown in Ferguson. He just knew the police were killing blacks just because they were black. He said, my findings were the most, quote, shocking of my professional career, close quote. Not only were the police not pulling the trigger on blacks just because they were black, as was the case with the studies that I mentioned in the Washington Post in July, in April, he said the police were more hesitant, more reluctant to pull the trigger on a black suspect than a white suspect. So the whole thing, Michael, is a con. The systemic racism thing is a con. It is designed to get black people to vote for Democrats because, after all, the Republicans are the ones who are not doing police reform the way you want. It's Republicans that are defending the police officers. It's Republicans that are advancing this, that are encouraging cops to engage in this kind of brutality against black people. That's what various people like Maxine Waters have either said outright or implied. Eric Holder has even said it outright or implied it. Obama has said it outright or implied it. It is a lie, and it's getting people killed.
You're listening to nationally syndicated conservative radio host, author, lawyer, and filmmaker Larry Elder. We'll continue the interview with Larry Elder in the next segment of the program. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap. Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career: Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics, also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap, let's get back to the conversation about race relations in America with nationally syndicated conservative African-American talk show host Larry Elder of the Salem Radio Network. You said earlier something about comply and you won't die.
George Floyd resisted arrest. Eric Garner resisted arrest. Freddie Gray resisted arrest. Michael Brown resisted arrest. Tamir Rice, you could say, resisted arrest. These killings would not have taken place had the civilians not resisted. Now, I'm not saying that this excuses officers' behavior, and we ought to, of course, scrutinize officers' behavior. But why haven't Obama, Eric Holder, Al Sharpton, any of these so-called black leaders said what I just now said? I did a video where the Phoenix Police Department were criticized by this local Al Sharpton type, and the Maricopa County Police said, look, every time there's a shooting like this, you have no idea what it's like to be a cop. Why don't you take the shoot, don't shoot drill, and you see what it's like to walk a mile in our moccasins. To this guy's credit, he did it. And after being there and taking the shoot, no shoot drill where he wasted a bunch of people because he didn't do the right thing, even though he was trained otherwise, he said, I had no idea how difficult it was to be a police officer, the split second decisions you have to make, and how important it is to comply. Now I see the importance and the value in compliance. Now imagine, instead of being in the streets yelling and screaming at the police officers, he'd been in the streets yelling and screaming at civilians, saying the first step is to make sure we don't escalate this thing. The first step is to comply. I've not heard any of these so-called black leaders say that, and I think it's appalling.
And that ties into a thing that a number of African-American parents have told me, most of them from the left side of the spectrum, that they have had this conversation, mostly with their young men in their family, And that is to, of course, be very careful if you're pulled over and what to do. And it actually is a black survival thing.
A cross-the-board survival thing. You don't think Bill Clinton told Chelsea the same thing?
Absolutely.
I mean, come on.
Absolutely.
When you come out of the womb, your parents sit you down at some point and say, look, if you're pulled over by the police, make sure your left hand is at 10 o'clock, your right hand is at 2 o'clock.
Right, right.
Make sure your paperwork is in order. Say yes, sir, say no, sir. And if something goes south, get a badge number or a name, and we can deal with it later. One more thing about this Derek Chauvin trial.
Yeah.
I wrote a piece, and it's called Derek Chauvin, the Great White Defendant. And I make an analogy between Derek Chauvin trial and the attention paid to it, to that wonderful novel written by Tom Wolfe called Bonfire of the Vanities, which was all about the pursuit of what he called the Great White Defendant, a wealthy, ideally wealthy, comforted white male who's done something wrong, and everybody enjoys watching this person skewer.
If you were assuming, okay, it's an individual white man, an individual black man. It's a trial of individuals. The nation's not on trial. The soul of the nation's not on trial. It's an isolated situation of just the facts. If you happen to be on that jury with all that knowledge, you somehow found yourself on the jury, would you have voted for him to be acquitted or found guilty?
Based on what I saw, and again, I didn't see all of it, I would say I saw roughly 40-50% of the trial. I would have found him not guilty of all three charges. I would have stood my ground.
That's Larry Elder of the Salem Radio Network presenting a conservative African-American perspective of the Derek Chauvin trial, police reform, and the state of race relations in America. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's pivot now to another somewhat different and perhaps more prevalent African-American take on the trial and the racial reckoning taking place in America. We're joined by Joe Madison, who hosts the extremely popular and influential morning show on the SiriusXM satellite radio Urban View channel. Joe, were you surprised by the verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial?
I didn't know what to expect. I think, Michael, the last time we talked, I had indicated to you that I was cautiously optimistic. I thought the prosecutors had presented a very strong case, but as all of us know, you don't know what a jury might do and how they're deliberating. I tell you what did surprise me was that it took less than 10 hours. Now, that was a surprise. To be quite candid, Mike, I was scheduled for a vacation, and we were trying to figure out in our shop if the verdict came down after I left for vacation, how were we going to broadcast? So, yeah, that was the surprise that it only took less than 10 hours.
Many people interpreted that, and of course, you know, the talk shows prior to a verdict or to some news event happening are very much like the pre-game shows before a sporting event, that everybody is telling what they think and what they think. Of course, then when the game starts, everything goes out the window. The speculation was that because it was so quick, and we had that 2 hours to wait between when they announced the verdict was found and then the reading of the verdict, most of the lawyers and the analysts were saying that a quick verdict often means guilty, to be precise. But people were very cautiously optimistic, and a lot of African American commentators in the media were very careful not to who wanted him to be found guilty were very careful not to claim victory until they heard it for themselves. There was a lot of skepticism because of the way so many other verdicts have gone. What do you think is next? Do you think that this is as historic in terms of setting the pace?
Let me respond, Ken, if you don't mind, Mike. Let me respond to that first part. That's interesting. And traditionally, you were right. Now, let me tell you what this talk personality immediately said. He's guilty. That was my response, like when I was told they've come back with a verdict. I said, nope, they got him. He's guilty. Now, the reason I thought that was because they had so much evidence to go over. So many expert witnesses And I thought to myself, this isn't the old South, where, you know, 12 white men deliberate and maybe stay long enough just to have lunch. No, the diversity of the jurors made me realize that 12 people probably sat in that room, and the evidence was so overwhelming that they probably took, it almost sounds like they took one vote. And that was my thinking. Now, your second question, where do we go from here? I think it is now in the lap of Congress. The Congress has got to get up off their butts, and they're going to have to work and try to find compromise to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. That's where the next big legislative fight is. And I would add this. I think they also, and it's a pet project of mine, they've got to pass the anti-lynching bill. And I've been promised by the likes of Steny Hoyer and Majority Leader Schumer that that bill will in fact be passed. And I think that sets us on a path to reforming clearly what has to be addressed seriously as it relates to policing in this country. So that's where we go next.
What about the hearts and minds of people, aside from legislation? What about just the day-to-day relationship between white people, black people, and in some cases, the relationship between black people and black people about this issue? And certainly, there's no doubt that by virtue of the multicolored crowds that have been demonstrating, that it's a white-to-white conversation as well. How about just the tone of relationships in general per the races going forward? Do you think that there's been a shift? Do you think that this has been an advancement toward harmony? Or does it run the risk of just being another, you know, interesting event and then it's forgotten?
No, it won't be forgotten. And I think every generation, we make improvements. I mean, let us understand historically, our founding fathers couldn't even handle or deal or come up with a solution for the question of slavery. It was the biggest debate, the most contentious debate they had in putting together the Constitution. We fought a civil war. We went through Reconstruction. We went through the Civil Rights Movement. We went through Jim Crow. We then came out of that with the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. The reality is that every generation we make improvements. I always admonish, particularly the young people in my audience who call in and say, "Well, nothing has never changed. Nothing has changed." That's the point I want to make. Nothing has changed, Michael. That is so historically inaccurate that it's almost embarrassing to have to talk about it. Of course we've changed. And every generation, we make improvements. It's not perfect, but I can tell you this, the two of us are old enough to know we're racially a lot better off than our fathers and grandparents were. And so I think what the strength I get from our discussion is just what you said. Look at the makeup of the demonstrations. This horde of young white people who have joined the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, you've got, can you imagine any time 3 or 4 decades ago, young white people carrying around signs that said Black Lives Matter? But I do remember young white students in my day going down to Mississippi and helping and giving up their summer vacations and going down and helping register people to vote in what they called called Freedom Summer. So we just have to be vigilant. We just have to keep pushing, moving forward. Michael, that I see it every day. I see it in my family. I see it in our relationship with each other. It's not perfect, but it's a lot better than it was.
I tend to agree with you completely on that, that it is better than it was, and that's a good thing, because the most we can hope for is that we're moving as a complicated society in the right direction. In conclusion, you mentioned voting back in the day. Voting back in this day is a very big issue. What are your thoughts in terms of the conversations you have on your show? What are your thoughts about the voting legislation that has taken place in Georgia and is now being brought up at state houses around the country?
Well, I think that what I would refer you to an exchange of I believe yesterday between Senator Kennedy of Louisiana and Stacey Abrams, where she delineated what she felt was wrong with the Georgia bill, which, by the way, is being duplicated in 45 other states. My audience is very clear about this. This is nothing more than an attempt to suppress the vote. That's all this is about. And I think that we're going to see lawsuits that are going to overturn some measures of these bills. But this was not an issue 10 years ago. And we keep saying this, Michael. Where is the fraud? Study after study after study has shown that the amount of voter fraud is no more than 0.0001%. It's almost non-existent. And so the reality is this is a reaction by the Trump supporters who were very displeased and disappointed and angry that he lost. And so this is nothing. And the reason he lost was because, in large part, African Americans turned out to vote in record numbers. And now you have states that are trying to figure out what's the most effective way to suppress their vote. And this is what I refer to as nothing more than a sophisticated Jim Crow attempt at what their fathers and grandfathers tried to do, except this is 21st century James Crow Esquire.
That's Joe Madison, host of the morning show on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's Urban View channel, talking about the Derek Chauvin trial and verdict, the number one topic this week on talk shows across America. Coming up next, a conversation with one of talk media's leading voices on the environment, Joan Michelson of the Green Connections radio podcast. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
Report is sponsored by IBM. The past year has transformed nearly every aspect of our world and has driven dramatic shifts in the way we shop, socialize, travel, and make daily decisions. However, according to a new global consumer study released by IBM's Institute for Business Value, consumers are optimistic about returning to life post-COVID-19 vaccine. The study of more than 15,000 adults globally found that the biggest shift will see consumers returning to in-person shopping, with in-store promotions being the top factor luring consumers to step indoors. Plane travel will also see an uptick, with 30% planning to fly more often. And roughly 1.5 times more vaccinated consumers surveyed expect to take an overnight trip within the next 6 months. Jesus Montes, Senior Managing Partner, IBM Global Business Services.
As we return to the post-pandemic normal, expectations of digital engagement will continue to be high. Businesses need to accelerate their digital evolution to provide hybrid physical and digital experiences, personalized and powered by AI and cloud technology.
For more findings, visit ibm.com/IBB.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. The annual day that serves as a focal point for environmentalism, Earth Day, took place on Thursday this week. With it came more of the growing conversation about climate change, as well as debate over the new Green Deal and whether it would be a good thing or a bad thing for the economy. And that, of course, all ties into the Biden Virtual Climate Summit that took place this week, a big week for the environment. We're joined now by Joan Michelson, host and producer of the Green Connections Radio podcast. She's one of the leading experts on the environment in talk media and a proponent of the environmental movement. Joan, you've been at the forefront of the environmental movement for a very long time. Now, here we have Earth Day, and President Biden is a bit more friendly toward your political point of view than Trump was. Basically, you've been saying that the environmental movement is not bad for the economy, as so many people have claimed. It doesn't stand in the way of business. It creates new business and new jobs and new opportunities. We just have to have the will to go through the transition. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, the new infrastructure bill that President Biden presented will create, even by the conservative estimates, about 3 million new jobs that would not have otherwise been created. And in fact, here's an interesting statistic which I used in Forbes this morning, and that is the amount of money we have spent in the United States on rebuilding after extreme weather events is almost exactly the same amount of money as the Biden infrastructure plan. It's within $100 million of the climate plan. That's amazing. And the infrastructure plan creates 3 million new jobs, and it drives innovation. It creates new industries. I mean, yes, there are people who are going to change jobs, but they're growing new skills, and they're being given new jobs, and in some cases, better-paying jobs. It's an actual job creator. I mean, there's so many new... I mean, look at how many jobs Tesla is creating, for example. And it's not just in that one company. It's the supply chains that evolve out of it. It's the ancillary businesses that show up to support it.
So, Joan, what are your thoughts about Biden having Communist China sit at the table at the climate summit this week?
So you know what? Co-optition is the name of the game. So we need China. China is, you know, obviously a ginormous economy, and they're actually doing a lot for climate change. They've done some not so friendly things, like dumping solar panels on the market, which reduced the cost of the United States made solar panels. But they've taken a lot of action on climate change already, and we need them at the table. I think you can walk and chew gum at the same time. I think they can hold them accountable for human rights violations at the same time that you collaborate with them on climate change. I don't think it's an either-or proposition. I think, in fact, if anything, bringing them to the table on certain issues can make it easier to address them, to challenge them on the harder ones, because it doesn't make it an all black and white relationship, pardon the expression. It makes it it's a duality. It's a complex, multidimensional relationship. We need them on North Korea also. I mean, we need them on a lot of other things. So I disagree that you can't have them at the table because of other infractions in this case. I think you need them at the table, especially when it comes to climate change.
That's Joan Michelson, host and producer of the Green Connections Radio podcast. For more information about Joan and the podcast, visit greenconnectionsradio.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. As evidenced by some of the diverse talk media voices heard on today's program, there are lots of different opinions being expressed in the media today. And of course,
One of the main topics discussed in the media is the media itself, and that includes accusations of media bias, social media bias, not to mention questions as to which way we're heading in terms of the First Amendment and free speech. Let's go behind the scenes now and talk with one of the leading talk radio programming and marketing consultants, Holland Cook, who also hosts his own weekly TV show, The Big Picture, on the RT America Network. We are living in what some people call post-truth America, and that is the era of alternative facts, people living in a bubble, and it really is a factor in the media today as to who you're talking to and what is their truth.
Who said it better than laughable Rudolph Giuliani when on Meet the Press he said, "Chuck, truth isn't truth." And I thought that one-upped the Kellyanne Conway soundbite of the year about alternative facts. But people choose their reality. And you could hook them up to a polygraph and the needles wouldn't flinch an inch.
That's the part of it that's so fascinating. You know, a polygraph does not know the truth. A polygraph knows whether or not you're sweating a little bit more, your heartbeat is a little bit faster, you might be a little bit flush, and it detects those changes that come when we uncomfortably tell a lie. But if you lie to yourself, if you lie to yourself and then you say what you think is the truth, that is your truth.
In the words of George Costanza, it isn't a lie if you believe it. Here's the problem with this pandemic. People get hurt. And it's COVID-19 because we came upon it in 2019. It's not COVID-1950 when we were learning about the flu. So the soreheads who are carping about wearing a mask, a Ted Cruz saying he will not wear one on the Senate floor, they're blaming Dr. Fauci for the message changing as we have learned more about what we need to do and what we don't need to do. And think back a year ago, we were cleaning surfaces like Lady Macbeth, and now we know better. We know what masks do and where we don't need them anymore. You're hearing a lot of experts this very week saying getting outdoors is a really big deal, but when you're indoors, you need the mask. So the truth does change as we learn more. The problem, and where people get hurt, is those who are so dug into what they wish that they are more comfortable with their truth, with their version of the data, which is not the data.
And that's the daily dance of affirmation that we talk about, and not to mention the other syndrome that we talk about on this program all the time, and that is seeking victory at the expense of truth. But this whole idea of changing your mind in the face of new evidence, I'm not sure if guys like you, who are consultants to programmers in talk media, necessarily advise that it's wise to do so. Because sometimes when people do that, the audience rejects them and says, hey, we don't want to listen to you anymore. We want to feel good about our position. And this goes on both sides. I don't want to turn this into like one side or the other, but this is an issue that the people that program radio and TV stations and target audiences have to deal with. It's got to be a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, the 15th century, people thought the world was flat. And then somebody proved that it wasn't. And there are a lot of flat earth people now as we are challenged by this pandemic. For instance, the sad state of racial affairs in America, you know, battle lines being drawn. But nobody's right if everybody's wrong. And when we can't agree on what time it is, what temperature it is, we have problems. To your point about programming the talk media, it's a product. It's a conveyor belt. And most of my clients are conservative media platforms. And I check my politics at the door because we're here to increase profitability, which happens when advertisers get results. And they get results when they hear the commercial repeated a bunch of times. And they hear it repeated a bunch of times because they listen more. And they listen more because they like what we're saying. It's strictly a matter of craft, how we get here. But I do feel like taking a shower at the end of the day.
I hear you. But it certainly is understandable on the other side of the coin why people are skeptical of a Fauci or skeptical of the media or their religious institution or their health care provider or their insurance company or the government. Because we've learned time after time during the past 10, 20, 30 years that a lot of these institutions that we rely on for credibility can't really be trusted. We've been talking with talk radio programming and marketing consultant Holland Cook, who also hosts a weekly TV show, The Big Picture, on RT America. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Okay, we got enough time now for a quick departure from our usual fare that perhaps ties into Earth Day. For most of my adult life, I've been an ardent supporter of animal welfare, which means I'm for the humane treatment of our fellow creatures here on planet Earth, and I hope you are too. I had the opportunity to write and record a song about the subject with one of my favorite bands, Gun Hill Road. They've been around since the early 1970s, and they just released yet another new album titled What Year Is This? And it includes a song titled I Know You're Real, for which I wrote the lyrics and recite the words. Here's how it goes.
I know you're real, I know you're real.
We are drops in the same endless sea, branches on the tree of to be. We think, we know, and we feel. Beams of light from the same shining star, spinning between what's near and far. I believe you are real. My eyes, mind, heart, and soul know you're real. I am sure you are real. We are words in the same simple prayer. All of our spirits are there. We are thoughts in the eternal mind. Now it is time to be kind.
I know you're real, I know you're real. Treasure I shall not steal. I know you're real, I know you're real. I understand that you're real.
We are notes in the same melody, singing in nature's sweet harmony. All of our spirits are here. We are grains on the same golden beach. The light is not out of reach. I truly know you are real. The spark of life is in your eyes. I truly know you are real. We are drops in the same endless sea, branches on the tree. A new day will dawn if we just have the will. I believe in thou shalt not kill.
I know you're real, I know you're real. Treasure I shall not steal. I know you're real, I know you're real. I understand that you're real.
That's I Know You're Real by the legendary rock band Gun Hill Road from their brand new album, What Year Is This? I wrote the words and I recite them on the recording. It's more apparent that the song is about the relationship between humans and animals in the video on YouTube, which has a series of extraordinary animal pictures and video clips guaranteed to tug at your heart. Gun Hill Road, I Know You're Real, the spoken word version. Check it out on YouTube. And that concludes this latest installment of our show. This has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at this past week of Monday, April 19th through Friday, April 23rd, 2021. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of The Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in conjunction with Talkers Magazine and Talk Media Network. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.